wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky.
Hello, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, the Prison Voices Project. I'm Alexandra Cox, a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective and an assistant professor of sociology at SUNY New Paltz. Happy New Year to all of our listeners. This week, I'm interviewing two leading thinkers on the history of criminal justice reform. The issue of reform is an especially salient one as we see a growing protest movement in response to the events in Ferguson and Staten Island, and as we celebrate the life of Dr. Martin Luther King this week. Many people are asking whether King's legacy is being resurrected by a newer, younger generation of protesters who are pointing to systemic racism and demanding that police stop occupying communities of color. Above the street, in the courtrooms, legislative offices, and advocacy organizations, reformers are advancing ideas about systemic change, including police body cameras, the diversification of police forces, and greater oversight of police forces. In today's show, we're going to look back in order to look more critically at what is happening in today's criminal justice system. Our guests, San Jose State University professor Anthony Platt and Princeton professor Naomi Murakawa, both provide us with incisive and critical takes on the very nature of reform and what it means for so many people caught up in the net of criminalization in America. I'm going to begin today's show with my conversation with Naomi Murakawa. Dr. Murakawa has just published an important new book, called The First Civil Right, How Liberals Built Prison America. She is an associate professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Murakawa trained in political science, and her book is an in-depth analysis of the relationship between state-sanctioned racism and imprisonment in America since the 1940s. I asked Dr. Murakawa if she could talk about what led her to her discovery that it was actually American liberals who helped to craft a great deal of the legislation and the legal reform strategies that have helped our prison state to look the way it does today, and to have such a serious and negative impact on people of color.
I started researching federal crime policy and its contribution to mass incarceration a little more than a decade ago. And I'll admit that the first draft of the book actually set blame squarely on the actors that the current version of the book now decenters. So the first version of the book actually laid blame with Republicans and Southern Democrats. As I was writing the book, in those sort of long weeks and months of rewriting, what happened was, you know, that I lost faith in the perspective that I originally started with. So there is a sort of conventional language that structures the way we talk about blame for mass incarceration. And we tend to tell a story of two competing, usually partisan sides. So we talk about there was a side that was more for retribution, but then another side that was more for rehabilitation. There was a side for individual responsibility. There was another side that was digging deep at the root causes. What happened when I was rewriting the book is that I was sort of banging these pairs of oppositions against each other, and the liberal side was just sounding a hollow thud. That is, all that was supposed to be there with the liberal attacks on root causes and a genuine, deep, liberal pursuit of good good rehabilitation programs, that just wasn't there. And that's when I started to wonder what was happening if we keep looking at a sort of rights-loving Warren Court or Northern Democrats who supported the Great Society, if we look at them and we think that somehow their history's virtuous losers. And when we look at them that way, they become just contrast background. And their story is quickly glossed, and they're presumed egalitarian. And what happened when I started looking a little bit more closely about a racial liberal legacy, really starting at World War II, what I found was that liberal proposals were not about attacking root causes or instituting rehabilitative programs. Their programs were much more about building a better criminal justice system to patch the discretionary openings through which they thought individual bias was slipping into the criminal justice system. So liberals pursued things like more funding for police training, more support for federal rights such as Miranda rights. They wanted to build sentencing guidelines to squeeze out the discretion from judicial powers and parole officers. And this is where I started thinking that the liberal crime agenda was not something that we could easily categorize as a war on crime or as a war on poverty, but really this was the liberals' war on the arbitrary.
I think what I would love just to hear you unpack more is what you, how you define racial liberalism.
So racial liberalism as an ideology that congealed really in the years immediately following World War II, is an understanding that witnesses race as arbitrary and therefore racism as a form of irrationality. And by calling it and thinking of it as an irrationality, we're supposed to think of racism as aberrant rather than normal. We're supposed to think of it as rooted in psychological error rather than rooted in rational capitalist self-interest. So once this became the sort of reigning ideology, it implied a set of interventions around criminal justice. So if racism is irrationality, then it's something that slips in the form of bias and comes into the system in these sort of through individual bad actors. So what becomes the agenda for eradicating racism from the criminal justice system? It has to be either fix those particular individuals, train them, or select them more carefully, or the program becomes patch the discretionary openings, lattice over procedure and layers of rights, so that there's less discretionary power for individual actors. And this became the liberal agenda of defeating racism. Really, I mean, it's kind of odd to say it, but in some ways, liberals built prison America by pursuing a perfect carceral state, by pursuing procedural perfection in the name of racial fairness, the fantasy that they could have a system that's rights-laden and rule-bound and therefore regimented enough to control bias in the system, and also, and this is important, one that looks fair enough to appease all would-be Black rebels. Right? One that looks fair enough so that people will not rise up in insurrection.
I mean, what you're saying, of course, has so much relevance for what the very conversations that we're having today. And I want to, and your thoughts about the calls for reform in policing today, and perhaps also what you, I mean, in some ways, what you're saying is that the kind of logics of racial liberalism form the foundations for what the interventions and calls for interventions today, and how they seem so reasonable to liberals today.
So we're at a dangerous moment for reforms. in part because there are huge calls to reform policing, and we now have a really entrenched liberal apparatus that's translating really progressive calls for reform into small, modest reforms in the tradition of liberal law and order. And these reforms are oriented around better evidence collection of what's happening with policing through the form of body cams. Or there are reforms like, we need a comprehensive study at the national level and we'll make recommendations to make things more uniform and aligned throughout the country. Or we have the standard practices of rooting out the bad apples and calls for things like independent prosecutors because a grand jury system is so corrupt. And what are these? These are all just reforms around the edges of policing. And I think the history of federal policing reform tells us that these are exactly the liberal interventions that are going to make policing stronger, bigger, more violent, and more legitimate all at once.
It's interesting. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about what I think is also the call for the expansion of so-called diversity in policing as fitting yeah. squarely into that project. And I kind of wondered your thoughts about that.
Yeah. So the call to diversify policing is longstanding. So we get one of the earliest federal calls in President Truman's Committee on Civil Rights, the report that came out in 1947 that said it was important to hire more minority police officers because those would be the officers that would look more credible in the communities that they're serving. So, and this idea of credibility in communities, of trust, of legitimacy of policing is a theme that comes up really across the board in these reforms. And I think we need to look closely at what reformers mean when they talk about the need to reinvigorate trust and stability. I think mostly what they mean is we need a police force that is credible enough to penetrate Black communities to get the real story and to make sure we can make arrests without having Black communities erupt into any kind of protests. So one thing that we might consider is that right now, Attorney General Eric Holder has convened his task force on 21st century policing. And when he talks about this and all that they're going to do, he notes that a study this grand has not been done since President Lyndon Johnson's Commission on Law Enforcement nearly half a century ago.
Our needed conversation must result in concrete action. But we need to have that conversation. We need to dedicate ourselves to coming up with action to deal with these underlying problems. Last August, with these goals in mind, I launched a new Smart on Crime initiative to strengthen communities, to improve public safety, and to make America's criminal justice system more effective and more equitable. Our actions under this initiative are born of the crucial recognition that growing both tougher and smarter on crimes means investing in innovations. It means striving for more just and more equal outcomes and rejecting any policy or practice that has the potential to undermine sound law enforcement or to erode the sense of trust that must always exist between police officials and the citizens that they serve. Now, as the My Brother's Keepers Task Force reported to the president last May, and this was months before events in Ferguson captured the headlines, months before that, that task force told the president that we need to do more to strengthen the relationship between law enforcement and their communities. This was a part of My Brother's Keeper. America's law enforcement leaders must ensure that every community can see that we are firmly committed to the impartial and aggressive enforcement of our laws and the unbiased protection of everyone in this country. Bonds that have been broken must be restored. Bonds that have never existed must now be created, because this is the fundamental promise that lies at the core of who we are, what we do, and what so many brave law enforcement officers sacrifice so much every day to achieve. And this is why I've been traveling around the country in recent days and over the past few weeks, and I will do so over the coming months, to meet with law enforcement, faith, and community leaders to strengthen our dialogue about cooperation and mutual trust. And I'm pleased to note that We're holding the latest in the series of meetings later today, here, right here in Memphis. And I want to emphasize that our shared dedication to integrity, equal justice, and the highest standards of fair and effective policing has always been at the heart of the Justice Department's efforts in every sector, in every city, in every town that our work touches. This is the dedication that drove me, shortly after I took office as Attorney General, to order an extensive review of the Justice Department's guidance regarding the use of race by federal law enforcement agencies, a directive that was issued by the previous administration in 2003. This guidance expressly prohibited federal agents from using race as a factor in their investigations unless they encountered specific, credible information that made race relevant to a particular case. But it did not prohibit the consideration of such factors as national origin, religion, gender, or sexual orientation. And it broadly exempted investigations and operations that implicated America's national security. An unduly, I believe, expansive exemption that was the subject of legitimate criticism. As Attorney General, I have repeatedly made clear that racial profiling by law enforcement is not only wrong, it's misguided, and it is ineffective because it can mistakenly guide and focus investigative efforts, waste precious resources, and ultimately undermine public trust in what it is that we do.
That was Attorney General Eric Holder addressing a My Brother's Keeper Community Challenge event in Memphis, Tennessee in December 2010. Our guest today, Naomi Murakawa, has been talking about Eric Holder in the context of thinking about liberal interventions into criminal justice system reform, and some of the ways that these liberal interventions actually support rather than fundamentally reform policing systems and the punitive state. Murakawa provides some context and history for the recent reforms by looking back at President Lyndon Johnson's Commission on Police Reform.
It's actually worthwhile to look back at what President Lyndon Johnson's Commission on Law Enforcement actually did a half century ago. What we have in that situation is that President Johnson actually impaneled the commission in the summer of 1965, when there was already deep concern about the growing power of the Black freedom struggle, and in particular, the ways in which police brutality was triggering uprisings. And when the commission was convened, they were really looking squarely at this question of how to build a better criminal justice system, by which it means how to build one that Black communities trust more. So the commission released its report in 1967, and it was a battery of proposals for building a better, stronger criminal justice system. It was more money for training the police, more money for hiring police officers of color, certainly more hiring of judges and more ways to contain their discretion. And what's so interesting in the language of this Katzenbach Commission is that it addresses very squarely the idea that in quote-unquote minority communities, police just aren't trusted. And it addressed this idea by way of saying that it's partially true that there's good reason that Black communities can't trust police officers. But it also had another thread that said, look, Black people have accumulated resentment and they are irrationally putting that resentment on police officers. So what do we do with that accumulated irrationality and resentment? Well, if this is really a matter of perceptions, then what we need is basically a PR campaign for our police. We need to actually make them look better. We have to make them look like a place where you can't easily put all that allegedly irrational accumulated resentment. One idea for doing that was to have more police officers of color. Now, we know actually a fair amount about police officers of color. And what we know is their behavior, once integrated into the police force and the police culture, quite predictably, their behavior is no different than the behavior of white police officers. And what's so problematic about intervening just in the name of making something rights-laden and rule-bound What's so problematic is that that standard cannot confront the two most egregious things about the carceral state, and those are its incredible scale and its incredible racial concentration. From the framework of being fair under racial liberalism, that framework tells you that your job is to process each individual through a criminal justice system that works through rules and doesn't deviate per actor, right? And then we're supposed to evaluate criminal justice system by the procedural quality by which we arrest, warehouse, and kill each individual. Mm-hmm. And as long as we use that standard, we have no way of talking about the numbers of concentration in Black communities, in Latino communities, concentration against LGBT and trans communities. There's no way for addressing that, and there's no way for addressing the overall scale of violence.
It fits squarely within this kind of colorblind racism dynamic, and in particular, it's this disturbing notion that the issue is not racism, it's just, and there's this underlying assumption that Black criminality is a real thing in some ways, and that, you know, that really if we just treat everybody the same way and we strengthen this apparatus, those who deserve to go to prison will go to prison and those who don't will not.
Yeah, that's exactly the argument. I want to pick up on one thing you said, which mm-hmm. is it's racial liberalism is still operating under this idea that Black criminality is real. Mm-hmm. And I think that the only real difference between conservative racial profiling and liberal racial profiling is that liberal racial profiling will claim to see an inner life in the Black psyche in a way that conservative law and order won't. So when I talk about when most people talk about racial liberalism, I'm thinking about scholars like Nikhil Singh and Chandan Reddy and Lonnie Guinier, and they're referencing this idea of racial liberalism as a kind of irrationality and a psychological defect. You know, it's clear that the irrationality has sort of different implications on the Black-white binary. So for white people, racial liberalism conceives of racism as a psychological irrationality. So it's an irrationality that's external. So mm-hmm. racism becomes a pollutant to the real self. But for Black people, under racial liberalism, racism is thought to be a psychological injury, one that is so disfiguring that it actually becomes, in some ways, constitutive of the notion of the Black self. In some ways, I think the paradigmatic figure of the liberals' form of racial profiling can be seen in Bigger Thomas, the protagonist from Richard Wright's 1940 novel, Native Son. And what we have here is an image of someone who ends up being tried in court for murder, and he's a young Black man. And, you know, what makes that image any different from the conservative image of your standard criminal as a young Black man? Well, the only thing that makes it different is that liberals will say this is someone who's been socially engineered to harbor frustration and rage, and they could erupt at any moment. So this is someone who, yes, has criminal propensities, but not because it's biologically innate and not because Black culture is intrinsically criminogenic, but because we have a white supremacist order that has engineered Black people to be criminals. Now, what's so dangerous about this is that this is actually a conception of Black humanity that is so figured on rage and frustration that it becomes a purely instrumental understanding. That is, in some ways, the image of Bigger Thomas was meant to compel reform. It was meant to compel a loosening of white supremacy. But it was done in terms that actually militate against seeing Black humanity because it saw Black humanity as instrumental. And when we look at a difference between, say, Bigger Thomas as the liberals' racial profile and, say, Willie Horton as the conservatives' racial profile, you know, I don't know what to say except this is the same profile.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
That was the 1988 attack ad created by George Bush's campaign team against Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis. The ad featured a prominent photograph of Willie Horton, a black man. The ad is widely known as a provocative attempt by Republican pollsters to draw on white racialized anxieties about black crime. I'm talking to Professor Naomi Murakawa, whose new book, The First Civil Right, How Liberals Built Prison America, has just come out. You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. It's this fantasy and the specter of black rage and black insurrection. It's as you speak, I hear it so much in the discussions about Ferguson amongst liberals that specter sort of haunts every conversation in a lot of ways.
Yeah, this is yes. It is this tendency in the liberals' understanding of racism to witness white supremacist violence and to say that the real danger with white supremacist violence is that it could provoke black insurrection. So, you know, you think about the Ferguson case, and I think about when the non-indictment came down, and then Officer Darren Wilson gave his public interviews. And, you know, we can listen to Darren Wilson, and in some ways, I can have a really uncomplicated reaction to him because he is so clearly moving through an understanding that he lives in a world of threats of potential Willie Hortons, right? And mm-hmm. his description is young black man, dangerous, pure force. He doesn't even flinch when a bullet hits him. He is pure thug. There is no inner life, right? And I have uncomplicated feelings about how problematic that is. It becomes a little different, I think, when then we have to listen to President Obama come out on the day of the non-indictment and say so insistently, this is rule of law. And then he switches immediately to, this is an instance of unreprimanded white violence. But really our biggest concern with this is that it might provoke black violence. His statement was, this is rule of law, and I understand some people might be a little frustrated, but you can't throw bottles, and you can't loot, and you can't set cars on fire. Very elaborate descriptions of Obama's fear. What he did is he took an instance of unreprimanded statewide violence, and he translated that into a bigger concern for him, which is black insurrection.
As all of you know, a few minutes ago, the grand jury deliberating the death of Michael Brown issued its decision. It's now come that either way was going to be subject of intense disagreement, not only in Ferguson, but across America. So I just want to say a few words suggesting how we might move forward. First and foremost, we are a nation built on the rule of law. And so we need to accept that this decision was the grand jury's to make. There are Americans who agree with it. There are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction. But I join Michael's parents in asking anyone who protests this decision to do so peacefully. Let me repeat Michael's father's words. Hurting others or destroying property is not the answer. No matter what the grand jury decides, I do not want my son's death to be in vain. I want it to lead to incredible change, positive change, change that makes the St. Louis region better for everyone. Now, Michael Brown's parents have lost more than anyone. We should be honoring their wishes.
That was President Obama's statement after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson in the Ferguson case. I'm talking to Naomi Murakawa, who's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. You're listening to the Prison Voices Radio Project.
The agendas for policing reform are so modest and constrained today that it even permeates our everyday language. So we have a tendency to criticize what we call police racial profiling and police brutality. And we're naming and challenging these things as if profiling and brutality are somehow just instances that happen discreetly and deviate from the normal practices of policing. And I think it's really important to clarify. There really is, in some ways, there's no such thing as police brutality. To speak of brutality is to problematize only the instances in which we happen to witness police use of force. But really, if you're being questioned by someone who has a gun strapped to their hip, and if you pay any attention to what's happened in the world, then really, the threat of death permeates your interaction with police officers so deeply that it is brutal. If there is threat of death present at any moment, that's brutal, full stop. Also, we talk about racial profiling. There's no such thing as racial profiling. To speak of racial profiling is to harbor the fantasy that there could be such a thing as colorblind policing. We don't have the possibility of colorblind policing because there's only policing in the world that we've made. And look, the world we've made is based on wealth-based residential segregation and racially stratified employment structures. And it's structured in a way that, you know, we have haves who want to do their shopping and eat dinner downtown without being bothered by the have-nots who are going to ask for change or make them feel uncomfortable. And then we have a police force that we ask to police the boundaries of all of that segregation and all of those rich-poor stratifications, right? Mm. Instead of talking about police brutality and racial profiling, instead of talking about that, we actually just need to talk about policing. And we need to actually talk about what it is we're empowering police officers to do. So when we talk about body cams and independent prosecutors or hiring more police officers of color or better police training, when we talk about those things, what we're saying is we want our police to be a little more polite as they are enforcing the law, a little more friendly. We want them to look a little bit more fair. We don't want them to be so quick to unholster their weapons, right? We're looking at how they're enforcing the law, when really the question we need to be asking is, why are we asking them to enforce so many criminal laws? Why are we asking them to enforce such a bloated criminal code? Because we criminalize everything. Any police officer, disorderly conduct, vandalism, loitering, trespassing, civil gang injunctions, curfew violations, selling without a license. We put these laws on the books, I think with almost a racist wink and a nod that says, we're going to give you these formally colorblind laws, but they're so capacious. They allow for arresting of so many people that you know what we mean. Just go out and arrest the disempowered people, the black and browns ones, the homeless people who are bothering us. Just go ahead and do those sweeps. You know, we need to be bold and stop putting the blame so much on bad police officers and redirect the blame back on ourselves, on what it is we choose to invest in, and our shortcut ways to dealing with all manner of social problems and social inequality by just criminalizing people and asking police to sweep them up.
It's so, what you're talking about too, just makes me think about a conversation we had not long ago about these kinds of issues in the context of prisons, and in particular, the kind of liberal concern in terms of regulating prisons and bringing attention to prisons only by understanding the most egregious violations by corrections officers. So if we think about the analog with police brutality, the overuse of restraints in juvenile prisons, or the overuses of violence by corrections officers. And rather than also looking more broadly as at the prison as just a repressive institution and as a place where brutality pervades everyday life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes. Mm-hmm. So we have all these really dangerous ways of picking select little problems, and then implicitly we end up saying that the larger system is okay. So there are huge campaigns against solitary confinement. Yes, solitary confinement is awful. But the normal day-to-day life in prison is awful. Mm-hmm. We're at a point where we are trying to think like carceral humanists or carceral feminists. And this is something that's being broadly critiqued. Actually, one of the best critiques of where we are with reform right now has actually been given by Deborah Small in her written work, but she was also on your show this summer, and that was one of the most extraordinary conversations about the perils of reform that I have ever heard. What we have to be really careful about is that as we are placing demands to dismantle the carceral state, we have to be really careful about positioning certain groups as innocent and okay, and certain groups as so horrible that it's just okay to put them away, right? And we see this sort of trying to do just little bits and little bits. Oh, the nonviolent drug offenders, they're the ones that are okay. Well, you know, yeah, they may be okay, but every time you're saying that, there is an implication that it's perfectly okay to have repeat violent people who are picked up on repeat offenses, and it's okay to just house them in a cage. It's not acceptable.
No, and it's a chipping away, which is a fascinating also logic. If you think, just thinking about all of the ways that you've described the kind of strengthening of the punitive apparatus. It's if you think about the trend towards, diverting nonviolent drug offenders and diverting people charged with nonviolent offenses, that what's interesting is it seems totally coherent with what you're talking about this broader strategy of making the system more rational and fair, and but actually strengthening it for those who remain and strengthening that kind of criminalizing apparatus for those who remain.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Where the place we need to come to is a place of asking ourselves why we've really, like, the cornerstone of our governance is putting people in cages. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to come to terms with, and to come to terms with the fact that there is no such thing as a humane prison. We need better goals than building the perfect prison and to have the nicest set of police officers who walk around with guns, hunting people, arresting them for small things.
After the Ferguson non-indictment came out, a friend of mine, the poet and author Reginald Dwayne Betts, shared a poem written about the aftermath of the Rodney King case, written by the poet Ai Ogawa. The poem really resonated with me, and I shared this poem with my students. I asked Dwayne to read it for this show.
Riot Act, April 29th, 1992, by I. I'm going out and get something. I don't know what, I don't care. Whatever's out there, I'm going to get it. Look in those shop windows at boxes and boxes of Reeboks and Nikes to make me fly through the air like Michael Jordan, like magic. While I'm up there, I see Spike Lee. Looks like he's flying too, straight through the plate glass that separates me from the virtual reality I watch every day on TV. I know the difference between what it is and what it isn't. Just because I can't touch it doesn't mean it isn't real. All I have to do is smash the screen, reach in, and take what I want. Break out of prison. South Central homie newly risen from the night of the living dead. But this time he lives. He gets to give the zombies a taste of their own medicine. Open wide and let me in, or else I'll set your world on fire. But you pretend that you don't hear me. You haven't heard the word is coming down like the hammer or the gun of this black sun. Locked out of the big house, while Massa looks out the window and sees only smoke. Massa doesn't see anything else. not because he can't, but because he won't. He'd rather hear me talking about more money, more honeys and gold chains, and see me currying my favorite things from looted stores than admit that underneath my Raiders cap, the aftermath is staring back. I'm blinking through the camera's lens, courtesy of CNN. My arms loaded with boxes of shoes that I will sell at the swap meet to make a few cents on a declining dollar. And if I destroy myself and my neighborhood, ain't nobody's business if I do. But the police are knocking hard at my door, and before I can open it, they break it down and drag me in the yard. They take me to be processed and charged to await trial while America forgets the day the wealth finally trickled down to the rest of us. Riot Act, April 29th, 1992, by I.
The next interview we'll hear from was done with Tony Platt, who is a professor at San Jose State University and a longtime prison activist. Platt's 1967 book, The Child Savers, which is about progressive-era juvenile justice interventions into the lives of poor children of immigrant families, inspired me to look more critically at what some of the repercussions of reform are. Platt found that rather than rehabilitating these young people, these reforms actually broadened and deepened the net of social control over their lives and those of their families. I spoke with Platt about his older work and his perspectives on present-day criminal justice reforms. So the Hudson Valley is in many ways the site of a lot of the early institutions of juvenile justice in this country. It was kind of the buildup of reformatories, and these large-scale institutions happened both in New York City but up here. So the reformatory for girls was established up in Hudson, which is, you know, where our radio show is based. And, you know, the history of the kind of progressive interventions into young people's lives is something that you've written about in your book. And I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit about the Child Savers Project and what it was, and then also potentially, you know, about what you think about the relevance of this project for today and how we can think about what reformers do in the system.
So in the late 1960s and early 70s, I worked on a research project that became a dissertation, and then it became a book called The Child Savers. It's actually just been reissued with some critical commentaries, so it's a book that's still in print. But I was part of a group of academics who were really developing revisionist views about American history. We were taking on some of the myths about American history, about the welfare system, about the political system, about the economic system, and about the juvenile justice system, which was the work that I was doing. And at the time that I was doing the research, the prevailing view about the history of juvenile justice is that the juvenile court was created first in Chicago at the end of the 19th century, about 1899, and then spread out all over the country. And that this was a progressive attempt to develop a more moderate, a more progressive, a more rehabilitative program for young people around the country. And that the juvenile court system did away with due process, it did away with lawyers for young people, and it basically argued that because we're organized like a medical model, concerned about the best interests and best needs of children, we don't need an adversary system, we don't need lawyers, we don't need defense teams coming into court, but we don't need an adversary proceeding. So when I began to do research and look at the actual reality of the juvenile justice system, I found that there were all these reformatories, so-called reformatories, and which were really prisons that were built in the late 19th and early 20th century that were used to house mostly working class and poor kids, and later on African American and Latino kids in other parts of the country as well. And that this was actually a very punitive system. So I argued in The Child Savers that the juvenile court was really expanding the net of social control. It was bringing all kinds of young people into institutions and getting rid of their liberty and intervening in their lives without actually providing with any due process or any adversary system. And so that made me very dubious about a lot of forms that sometimes happen in the name of criminal justice, that things that we think are often set up to provide services and programs to people are actually then become the back door to more repressive practices. So I think before reformers plunge into proposals for new ideas and new ways of doing things, it's also useful to look back and see what happened to those programs. And those programs actually, in the early 20th century, were pretty disastrous because they cut children off from their families and their communities. The recreated small cottage systems ended up being very punitive, and the reformatories ended up in some ways being worse than prisons. So it's not to say that we shouldn't look at reforms and shouldn't try to figure out ways of doing things that will alleviate people's lives, but it's also important to try to have a historical grounding of what was tried before. And I think particularly in criminology and criminal justice, there is a long history of all kinds of so-called reforms that actually made things a lot worse. The prison itself, you know, which really begins as in the 17th century in Europe and in the United States, the prison itself was a reform. Mm-hmm. People said, well, the prison will be a better way to deal with people rather than putting them in stocks or executing them or cutting off their arms or their hands and so on. So the prison itself was a reform system, and now, of course, it's this monster that is out of control, that we're having trouble dealing with. But there are many other programs like that where people have intervened in the name of wanting to do good and wanting to better things. But in fact, the history of that has turned out to be more punitive.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about the cottage system, because I think it is, you know, in particular affects our region in the sense that it also, some of the dynamics that undergirded the creation of the cottage system was this also this other notion that fresh air and country life would be reformative for young people, and I think was, you know, led to the establishment of many of these facilities far outside of New York City and have created kind of dependencies in the local economy around these institutions, and also certain logics or ideas that people believe in about fresh air and country life healing the wounds of criminality.
I wanted to introduce the C word, class, because however different kinds of reforms are around the juvenile justice system or the criminal justice system in general, I think we also have to look at the fact that we know from all kinds of studies that criminal activity and antisocial activity cuts across all classes in American society. That middle-class kids, you know, do as many drugs, they're engaged in sexual assaults, they're engaged in the legal marketplace of consumption of illegally produced goods and so on. We have all kinds of studies that confirm that. But we also know that historically middle-class families who have problems with their kids are able to track them away from the criminal justice system. They have resources and money to send them to a private school or to a military school or to send them out of the country, or to provide them with therapists or extra programs and extra help and so on. And so you get this tracking that goes on amongst young people's criminality, that are working class and poor kids are the ones that end up in this system, however good or bad it is, whereas middle class kids usually are exempt from it. And I think that's a fundamental injustice about the criminal justice system that has to be dealt with, because as long as you have a system that is designed to regulate and control one set of people and to let another set of people go free or maneuver around it, that fundamental injustice has to be addressed.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm Alexandra Cox. I'm speaking with Dr. Anthony Platt, who's a visiting scholar at Berkeley Law School and the author of The Child Savers. We're talking today about the history of reform and the futures of reform.
You know, I remember back in the early 70s, there were movements within police departments by progressive police officers who wanted to be anti-racist and to fight against racism. There was a group called Officers for Justice in San Francisco. There were cops taking classes at the Berkeley Criminology School in the early 70s who didn't want to see themselves as being repressive, being, you know, on the side of just putting people away and being racist and so on. And that contradiction is there. It's often not looked at, but I think we need to also figure out ways of trying to reach people that work in these institutions to show that they have more in common with the people that they're supposedly guarding and policing than the people who are running the cities.
Absolutely.
I mean, I was just looking at today's New York Times. I mean, there's maybe a dozen stories in today's paper that deal with issues, race, crime, prisons, policing. It's incredible. I mean, this is now part of a whole national public debate that's going on so quickly. But it, you know, even though I've often been on the other side of police operations and subject to police violence and so on, and been a critic of the police, in a way, it's also, I think, important to understand how policing, particularly in the 1980s and 1990s, was given the job of filling the gap of all the social welfare programs that were abandoned and gutted, and all the public health programs that were closed down. And the cops were then expected to be the people in the community that deal with these issues and deal with them by basically containing populations or putting them in jail. And jails have become like the new mental health institutions in the United States. So without giving up a critique of policing and what police have to do, it's also important to understand the position that they've been put in. I noticed recently, in terms of a lot of the critiques of policing that we see coming out of community activists and magazines and journals talking about policing, there's a focus, for example, on how the police have become militarized in the last 20 years, and how, in particular, they've received a lot of weapon systems that have been abandoned and sold to them or given to them cheaply by the military. So it's like Iraq war. Hardware is now finding its way to different police departments and so on. That's true, but police militarism goes much deeper and much further back into American history. There was a huge reorganization of American policing in the early 1970s when the military model was adopted and the police were upgraded and given all kinds of technological equipment and put in specially developed cars and given walkie-talkies and given weapon systems and non-lethal weapons and so on, that they began to think of themselves very much as a military occupying force, and they were dressed and looked that way. And even for police who wanted to be closer to communities, it's very difficult to do that when you look and act like a military operation. But also, I think you can go much further back into the 19th century, actually, when the police were called in to deal with labor disputes and socialist organizing and particularly efforts to develop unionization. The police were called in and were given all the extra weapon systems and militarized to deal with those movements and to repress them. And if you go back and read those accounts of policing against the major union movements and labor strikes, they will seem very familiar to what's going on today. So, yes, there have been changes and there have been new weapon systems, and now we're going to have new projects involving cameras and other kinds of things. There's all kinds of gimmicks that are usually making profit for some producer. But I think it's important to understand that the militarization of policing has a long, long history and goes back to a model of counterinsurgency that comes out of the labor movement of the late 19th century.
It's fascinating.
And why it's important to do that is not just to say, well, you know, it's got a long history, but also to recognize how deep these issues are and how deep these problems are, and that transforming American policing will require huge changes in policing culture, in the way in which police are trained, in the way in which their job is defined, and the way in which they look, and their relationships to the community, a strong repressive function. And so, not to say that we shouldn't consider reforms today or think about ways of getting rid of the military hardware that they've got from the Iraq War, but to understand that there's a much deeper set of problems that have to be addressed here.
It's so interesting because you actually make me refine my final question to you, which is, maybe I don't know the best way to put it, but I just came back from visiting someone on Sunday at Eastern Correctional Facility, which is a maximum security facility nearby. And he said to me that Ferguson and Garner were the talk of the town. Those were his words. Which, of course, they are. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. But I wonder, you know, for people inside who are obviously thinking about Ferguson and Garner, how can we connect conversations about policing in America to incarceration more broadly to think about abolition as a possibility, and how might you connect a conversation about abolition to what's happening in response to Ferguson and Garner?
Well, I think this is an important moment in history. It's been a long time since we've had any kind of national debate about these issues. So it's extraordinary to pick up a paper or watch television or to see the marches going past my home here in Berkeley last night. There's definitely something happening around these issues all around the country, and that the focus is a lot on policing and police racism and police violence, but it wasn't too long ago that people were also writing and talking about and demonstrating against mass imprisonment, the use of solitary confinement, and the use of administrative segregation, and that's a big issue in California. We had a hunger strike here last year that was very successful in reaching and educating a lot of people. But I think the problems of trying to develop a movement that does something that's more long-standing and more secure and that's more effective requires people to be understanding, I think, the interconnections between these different issues. Racism, poverty, tracking in education, the interventions in the lives of poor kids and tracking them away from the possibility of universities, the massive increase in imprisonment, the use of special programs in prisons to really isolate people and intimidate people, which I think comes out of the efforts of political organizing inside prisons in the 70s, police racism, police violence, which is just so routine, that I think we need to build a movement that takes this energy and this anger and this concern that is now being expressed on the streets and develop a movement that understands the interconnections between these different kinds of issues and talks about solutions that are interconnected. I think the American left and progressive movement has, in many ways, become too specialized, too isolated from one another. There's huge energy all over the country. There's all kinds of movements. There's all kinds of activism. But I think we need to build a movement that understands that what happens with police violence is very much related to what happens with solitary confinement in a prison and what happens in the class divisions and the racial divisions in the educational system. That's where I think we need to lead. I think people who raise issues about just police violence or just the need for abolition, those are important. I mean, people need to have specialized approaches to issues that concern them. But it's the interconnections between these issues that I think we need to be figuring out ways to create again. I think we're very good at critique. I mean, that's probably what I've been talking about today. We can critique the racism, we can critique the overuse of imprisonment, we can critique police violence and so on. And I think we're still pretty good at raising, you know, utopian possibilities for the future, that this is not the way that we need to live together, that human beings have a greater ability of cooperation and interdependence than the way that we treat each other now. But at the same time, I do think we need to stake out what we think about specific kinds of reforms. Mm-hmm. I think those of us who are activists and are concerned about these issues, we need to stake out the middle ground of what kinds of reforms would make sense. Okay, we think the idea of cameras for the police is sort of ridiculous. We know that people can look at the footage from cameras and still not see what's before their eyes. We saw that in the beating of Rodney King. We've seen that in the recent incident of the chokehold that led to death and so on. So, yeah, we can critique that and say that's a cosmetic approach. It's not going to make any difference. But at the same time, I think we need to have to talk about and think about what would make sense in the middle term, in terms of we have our vision, we have our critique, but what kinds of reforms would make sense in the short term? Because it's a long journey ahead.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, second floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish